Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So today's episode is the last hardware company that I had a chance to talk to this year at Augmented World Expo 2026. And it was kind of a scrappy upstart called Raven Resonance, where they had this display glasses prototype with hot swappable batteries. It was running on Linux, and their PR representative came up to me and tracked me down and invited me to come check it out. And just the fact that it was running on Linux was super interesting to see how that was really amenable to hackers to be able to kind of hack around with and potentially even add different like hardware modules to whatever they're doing on their headset. And so also very, very, very concerned around privacy in terms of having by default these physical covers over the lenses. And so this was sort of an interesting emergent conversation where I started off talking to Parth Arora, but then the founder, Thomas Suarez, eventually came back from a meeting, and then he kind of jumped into the conversation to wrap up and give more of a vision of the founding story, as well as their commitment to fighting against aspects of surveillance capitalism, which I always love to hear. And it was sort of weird because they weren't necessarily showing what I would say were working demos fully. I mean, I could see a display, but they didn't have anything on the showroom floor that was like demonstrating the full eye tracking capabilities and the full interface that they're imagining. And also the hot swappable batteries were a little fidgety in the way that they would be kind of falling off in a way that they weren't necessarily super secure. So whatever they were showing there was not going to be like the final project. It was more of like to give you an idea for where they're going. But because they had this commitment to Linux and not necessarily open source in the way that I think they're still going to have like a traditional app store model, even though it's running on Linux, you would imagine that, oh, wouldn't you be able to just like put on whatever you want? I imagine there's going to be a certain amount of that, but I think there's also going to be a bit of kind of the traditional model of what everyone else is doing in terms of having their own store and ecosystem. But because it is Linux, who knows whatever happens, you know, with Valve coming out with the Steam Frame with Arch Linux, they're promising the ability to be able to basically put on whatever operating system you want. I'm not sure that Raven Resonance is going that far, but it is a potential platform to be able to do something that's highly hackable. It sounds like that Thomas Suarez himself was using a bit of a jailbroken version of Google Glass for a number of years. So he's lived a number of years already, probably well over a decade with Linux on his face. And so he wanted to kind of bring the power of Linux to people's faces. So I think that's a bit of what Raven Resonance is aspiring towards. And it's certainly one of the companies that I want to keep an eye on in terms of it kind of aligns with my own values of both privacy, but also trying to create more hackable, interoperable, and kind of leaning into more of the open source ethos as we kind of mash different aspects of AI with XR. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode, the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Parth and Thomas happened on Wednesday, June 17th, 2026 at Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hi, I am Parth, and I lead human interaction and software at Raven Resonance. And Raven Resonance, we just announced our first product, Raven Prism. It's an early preview, a hardware preview of our prototype that we are sharing. It's the first ambient computer. And what I mean by ambient computer is it has an entire Linux SoC on device, which means you can run small language models on device, you can AirPlay to it, you can watch YouTube to it, all locally, because it's a computer on its own by itself, a standalone product. There are a bunch of more features we can talk more about, but yeah, we're excited for it.
Great. Maybe you could give a bit more context to your background and your journey into working in the space.
Yeah, sure. So I have been in VR and AR for about 4 or 5 years now. I started personally with developing for Meta Quest and other VR platforms. And I joined this research lab in college, which was led by Thad Starner, who's a pioneer of Google Glass. And he did a lot of Etsy and software for that. And I worked with him and I got into this whole ambient computing space. And I started wearing and daily driving more glasses that were out there, like Vuzix and even Realities. And I started seeing value. And there wasn't something in the industry that something we really wanted, that something had the right combination of features that we really wanted a true ambient computer to have, something for it to be useful while it was stylish. And that's why I wanted to work on this. But our founder, Tom, so he's been passionate about this field since decades. He's been wearing Google Glass for more than 12 years. And yeah, I know, right? So it's this is a computer that he's wanted to see exists and it doesn't yet. A lot of the decisions, like intricate decisions about this entire product, are made around someone who's worn this pair of glasses, a pair of heads-up display for a long time. And yeah, that's why we are excited to launch Raven Prism later this year.
So it's a monocular display. Maybe you could just give a bit more context and details for what kind of specs this has from the display, resolution, and also all the compute and everything else.
Yeah, so I'll give a quick rundown. So as I mentioned earlier, it's an ambient computer, which means it has its own SoC. So it has an ARM64 quad-core. It runs Linux. It's our custom version of Linux, calling Raven OS. It has...
what's it built upon? Is there an existing kind of Linux base that people can associate for what it's like flavor-wise?
Yeah, so Yocto. It's a Yocto version. And continuing, so we have a full-color display. It's akin to a MacBook Air 16-inch and arm's length. It has cameras, it has speakers, mics. It has eye control as a primary input method, which means you use your eyes to control the user interface. It also comes with hot swappable batteries, which is you have to, you can take the batteries off and swap them with the charged ones. It's really cool. You have to see it in person. And that makes sure you have all day power. It also comes with a camera cover, which is on by default, and you have to manually take the cover off in order to actually use the cameras. I think everyone in our team, especially Tom, cares a lot about privacy for a product like this. That's one of the reasons we put compute on device, so that none of the user data, none at all, leaves the device. It's always encrypted and stored on device. People have to explicitly take the camera cover off if they want to use it. And even when the camera cover is off and they want to use the cameras, the bottom rims of the glasses itself, they light up completely. So it's very hard to hide them with a cover or something. So it's very explicit to the user and the bystander that the camera is on. And yeah, that is a quick rundown of all the specs that we have.
And so maybe you could give a bit more context for how do you start to get a sense of the power of this and benchmarking, and how do you start to evaluate what this onboard compute can do?
Yeah, so it can basically run anything like a laptop can, which means you can run language models on device locally. So all the speech-to-text and text-to-speech happens on device. You can watch YouTube videos on device. You can open a browser. You can SSH into it. You can run some really good smartphone-grade apps as well. So yeah, it's a whole computer on its own, and it doesn't need to dial home, or it doesn't need to another phone, or it's not an accessory to something. It doesn't need a phone or anything for compute, but yeah.
Nice. And is that Tom right there?
So that's Tom.
Oh, okay. So Thomas just walked up, and we're going to also include him. So hello. Hi. I'm Kent. I do the Voices of VR podcast, and we've heard a little bit about what's going on here. So maybe just kind of introduce yourself and what's happening here.
Sure. Cool. Yeah. And I'm very familiar. So thanks. Yeah. So I'm Tom, the founder of Raven Resonance. We're here previewing Raven Prism, which is the first ambient computer in the form of glasses. It's distinct from smart glasses in that smart glasses are typically more tethered devices, have compute off onto a puck or something else like that. All the compute is on device. So it's an ARM64 system, runs in the temple, so there's no other device required. It has hot swappable batteries through this Raven Wing ecosystem, where you can also have other hardware modules. So it's kind of an extensibility like extension port. And then we have eye control as well. So that's kind of the main input for the device, eye control and voice.
Nice. Maybe you could give a bit more context to your background and your journey into the space.
Sure. So I've been working in augmented reality and wearable computing since 2013. Started wearing Google Glass around that time, actually. And of course, there's a lot of lessons that are learned from, you know, Google Glass and those other devices. But I actually used it with Linux for a long time. So I had a rooted version of that. And I used it with a one-handed corded keyboard called the Twiddler. So I was using that for many years and felt firsthand what it was like, you know, for about 12 years to have Linux on my face. And it was super helpful, not only for, you know, note-taking and writing code on the go, but just to have this contextual information that is there when I need it and gone out of the way when I don't. And that's what we're trying to do here. And that's kind of the ambient part of what we're doing.
Nice. And maybe, I know watching a documentary with Steve Mann, I saw him while he was walking around in the park with a corded keyboard, like typing his dissertation or something. And so like there's this back of the mother of all demos. There was like the first demo of a corded keyboard where you play more like chords, but the kind of mobile portableized version of that is sort of like, I guess now just coming into Well, Steve Mann was using them, but do you expect people to kind of have a corded keyboard, or do you expect people to use natural language to speak things out? And I'm sure there's privacy implications where you might want to keep things private. So yeah, I'm just curious, after someone who is a corded keyboard user, if you expect to see if things like this are going to drive people to want to have more sophisticated voiceless input, or if you feel like everything's going towards being able to use voice.
Yeah, so I mean, coming from a corded keyboard with another device to this, it's really important to me that it's accessible and that there's, you know, the Twiddler and other corded keyboards have very high learning curves. It takes actually months to get fluent at these things. And even with daily use, I'm talking like up to 70, 80 words a minute. And we want eye control, you know, and voice input, because we want it to be hands-free, so you don't have to have something that you touch. Even with, you know, having like a neural band or something like that, it's really cool, but it still keeps one of your hands occupied. So most of the use cases that we're targeting are technical creative ones. So people have their hands full already and they need a way to input to the device without it being distracting. And so that's one of the reasons that we actually have the display kind of off to the right side. But the other thing is it needs to be private. And that's a mixture of eyes and voice. The voice aspect of it, we actually do the text-to-speech and speech-to-text on device, so it doesn't have to get beamed to a cloud. You can opt in to use cloud models, you know, for higher accuracy and things, but that's a big part of what we're doing here. It's extremely important that, you know, and we have the responsibility as like a hardware and software vendor to build the right privacy architecture, you know, not only encryption at the lowest levels, but also a camera cover. And so what you can see here on this device is a physical camera cover. And so you actually have to take the camera cover off in order to use the camera. And so that's just a little bit of added trust for people around you that, hey, the camera is definitely covered. It can't be, you know, messed with in software, that kind of thing. And we also try to keep as much on device as possible. The device is not phone home at all. And you can opt in for telemetry, but by default, we don't even collect telemetry. So this is something that's very, very important to us as someone who's building something that is essentially the extended eyes and ears of whoever wears it.
Yeah, I know that in the history of the internet, we have this moment of like all this like big tech companies that are with these surveillance capitalism business models. There seems to be a little bit of an uncritical combination of XR and AI in a way that is sort of like feeding all this data into these companies in a way that you have like no real protections with the third party doctrine of the Fourth Amendment, where anything that's given to a third party has no reasonable expectation to remain private. So just curious to hear a little bit more around your own journey around emphasizing privacy on these devices and why you think it's maybe a differentiating factor or something that is important.
Yeah, I mean, like, first of all, our entire team despises surveillance capitalism. And I'm happy to say that, because I think someone needs to say it in this industry. There's way too much, you know, way too many people just quite frankly abusing user data in this industry. And it kind of pisses me off. And I think we need to take a very strong stance against this, because it's not just about the data collection. That's the problem. It's what happens downstream of the data collection. And I could, you know, there's a million different problems with mass data collection in this sort of thing. And so, you know, we have actually even turned down investment from people who, you know, it's hard enough to get investment for AR, but we actually turned down investment from people who have called it data goldmine. That's the easiest way to make my blood boil. So I think it's, again, it's like extended eyes and ears. Anytime you're creating something that is going to be in a very high trust environment, which is, you know, something like literally being able to being in every environment that a person is in, whether it's a public setting or a private setting or some intimate setting, that needs to be protected. And not only do you have to set, you know, it's not, you can't just add privacy permission toggles at the end. It doesn't cut it. Privacy has to be built into the architecture from the beginning. And I think, you know, when we think about like going to an ODM to white label design, that was certainly one option, but we decided to build everything in house, partially so that we can have, you know, a lot of care and over the design and exactly how we want to build it, but partially so that we can verify every level of the stack.
And can you talk about what Linux gives you in terms of privacy architectures that you're able to kind of build off of?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, there would be multiple operating system architectures that would allow us to build kind of a private infrastructure. A lot of it happens in hardware. So, you know, making sure that, you know, we have secure boot and cryptography and keys that are burned in a very specific way at manufacturing time. So that's kind of more on the hardware level. And on the software level, making sure that applications are containerized and sandboxed. And, you know, there are other companies who have done that sort of thing as well. But then also making sure that there's permission, you know, very explicit user permissions when any data needs to get processed by a more powerful model than you could put on a phone or on the device.
Can you give me some examples or anecdotes of what it's been like to live with Linux on your face for like 12, 13 years? Or what kind of stories do you have of like the type of power that's unlocked for what becomes available?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I SSH'd into my wearable computer. And that was a very strange, like SSHing into glasses is kind of a very strange phenomenon, but it's really powerful. And, you know, on this particular device, there's a quad core ARM64 processor. And one of the interesting things has been certainly been, you know, Claude code on the go. I think that's been very, very cool. But also being able to run, you know, a full Python interpreter on there, being able to take existing applications from C and Rust and run them on there. And, you know, having a graphical user interface that is super responsive, like from a input modality standpoint, eye control is just really magical. And it'd be very, very difficult to do that without a very high powered system like what you find on Linux. So, you know, we've used other devices that run Android, for example, as their core. You know, that also provides a lot of power. But with Linux, you also get that power coupled with, in some ways, a little bit more efficiency. You know, you don't have to run a virtual machine. And you also get the openness where you can actually SSH in and do what you want.
Maybe we could talk a bit about both the eye covers for the lenses, but also they were talking about how you've got the bottom part of the glasses like are radiating a certain light to say like whether or not you might be using the cameras for more passive consumption of the world, but also if you're recording, you have a different color. So yeah, just, you know, there's been a lot of the Meta Ray-Ban glasses that people have been disabling the light so they can do all sorts of like creepy, serendipitous, hidden camera type of stuff that I think there's a bit of the glass hole effect that happened with Google Glass that I expect that at some point we may see something similar with anybody that is wearing glasses on their face may be a target for the larger tech backlash that we have for people resisting against big tech. And so, yeah, just curious to hear a bit more around your design considerations to occlude the lenses, but also the different ways that you're trying to have some design solutions that are creating a different type of social contract, informing people as to what might be happening on the glasses.
Yeah. So there's kind of two aspects. We wanted a restriction, you know, a physical restriction that's going to make it obvious to people when the camera's in use. And we also want an indicator. And they're kind of two different things. The restriction is the, which is, you know, again, manually very easily removable, but it's a removable privacy cover over the camera. And so this is, again, a preview. So it's not the full launch. The implementation is going to be a little bit different than what you're seeing here. It's, you know, not going to be necessarily just something you can detach and lose, and it'll be kind of more a little bit easier to hold on to, but it is going to physically cover the camera. And then the other one is indication, and that's the beacon lights that you were talking about, BEACON. That's like a bird pun. And so the beacon lights are basically just a very subtle glow that happens. There's a couple of LEDs in the frame here, and it's very subtle, kind of blue light. Again, colors, final color is CBD, but it can just fade in and out. And it's just a very subtle, you know, it's not too crazy, like a blinking red light that makes people feel uncomfortable. It's just a sign that says, hey, something's happening with this device that you should be aware of. And, you know, it just kind of changes the conversation around camera privacy. And we definitely don't want the glass wall effect.
Yeah, well, this is a very exciting liminal transition period where if we go back to the beginning of the internet, 1989 was when Richard Stallman came up with the GPL license for the first time in that February, where the first decade of the internet fueled on open source. Revolution OS is a really, really great documentary that covers that first decade. And then you have the beginning of the walled gardens in 2007, where you have iOS and Android. And now we're kind of in this point where do we want the future of computing to be in the power of the hands of the people with something like Linux, or do we want to surrender our sovereignty over to these, you know, tech oligarchs and trillionaires now, trillionaire companies and trillionaire individuals that are having these walled gardens that are controlling our digital futures in a way that is almost like this technological feudalism. So just curious to hear how you start to understand what's at stake in this moment and why something like a Linux operated glasses is a key part of putting the power back into the hands of people.
Yeah. I mean, from an open source standpoint, to be clear, you know, a lot of the hardware and the software at this moment is not open source. It is open platform. So it is an ecosystem. We do want to open source more of the software over time, for sure. But building on a Linux architecture allows people and making sure that the device is not only secured at the kind of the low levels and with containers, but still allows developers to do what they want is really important. You know, there's kind of the, you could go down more of the traditional iOS direction. I mean, iOS and Android are kind of very similar nowadays, but you could go down the more traditional iOS direction, as you mentioned, which is start really closed and then kind of open up slowly over time as more functionality comes out. It'll start with the Android model, which is kind of more start really, really open, really broad. And then, you know, they kind of close it up a little bit more over time with certain privacy permissions. And we think that both are possible at the same time. You just need to make sure that the surface area, you know, for a potential attack, for example, is very limited and is only kind of happening at user space and is only happening when there's explicit user consent. But if the user consents to having a lower level, or like an application that they develop kind of going lower level, then that's completely fine. It's up to them. It shouldn't, it's not up to us to decide. You know, we can encourage responsible use and we can integrate into the hardware architecture certain safeguards, but ultimately, you know, it's not our job to dictate to people how they should use the device, where they should use the device, and, you know, what they're allowed to run on the device when it's their device. So I think that's like the idea of not quite Libre, but similar, right? Allowing people to do what they want.
Great. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of XR and these types of open systems might be and what they might be able to enable?
Yeah. So right now, there's a great quote by Ross Finman, who's the founder of Escher Reality, who was acquired by Niantic. And he said that in order for someone to build the iPhone of AR, someone first has to come along and build the iPod. And that's the way that we think about it here. The iPhone of AR is still a few years away. It's hard to say. This is all the industry expression of it's, you know, AR is 2 years away every year for the past 30 years. It's kind of true. And so I won't estimate exactly when it's going to happen, but we believe to our core that it's going to happen. We believed it for a very long time. And I think that this device, either this Gen 1 or potentially, you know, in the near future, has the potential to be that kind of first step to an act to a really, you know, mass market, but more importantly, mass accepted product in society that leads us into building an iPhone of AR, which would be more of a spatial device. So that is on our roadmap, fully spatial software being represented as 3D objects in the space around you. We're working on it. There's still more to share on that, but we're really just focused right now on getting out this Gen 1.
And just to clarify, can you elaborate what was announced here at AWE and what's next for what we can expect for the timeline moving forward?
Yeah, so this is kind of an early preview of Raven Prism. We're here with prototypes. It's not the final device. The final device will come later this year, and it'll be, you know, more or less the same form factor, you know, maybe a few small tweaks here and there. We're going to show a lot more of the software at that time, but and it will actually be shipping out to first customers at that time as well.
Do you have a price range in terms of under 1,000, under 2,000, under 3,000?
Yeah, I can say this is an expensive device to build. I mean, we're not cutting any corners on it. And since it is low volumes at first, it will definitely not be under 1,000. The exact price is TBD, you know, to be announced, but yeah.
Cool. And anything else left unsaid? Do you like to say to the broader immersive community?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've covered most of it, but I'm very excited for this space in general. I mean, I think there's a lot of people trying a lot of different things, which is always really exciting just for me personally, because I mean, we've both been in this industry for a long time. And, you know, I think it's important to remember that we do stand on the shoulders of giants. There have been people working on this for decades and decades. And it's something where I think we need to live in the moment for sure and think about the future, but also just remember the past and, you know, learn from people who have been doing this for a long time because they have a lot of wisdom to share. And I think it's overlooked sometimes.
Awesome. Well, Thomas, thanks so much for joining me here to give a bit of a preview of what's happening with the Raven Resonance. Looking forward to see where you take this. And so thanks a lot for joining me here on the podcast. So thank you.
Thanks, Kent.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesvr. Thanks for listening.